Good morning. Can everybody hear me okay? I'd like you to welcome to the variance paper session this morning. I'm Bob Wolf. I work on the program planning committee. So on behalf of the authors here, we'd like to thank you for joining us on the third day in the first session in the morning. I know we're tired, but I think we're going to have a thought-provoking session here. Because I've got the pleasure of introducing two great authors, two great papers, and it's on our favorite topic, predictive modeling and loss reserve variability and all that kind of great stuff. So first one's entitled, Obtaining Predictive Distributions for Reserves Which Incorporate Expert Opinion. This paper is written by Professor Richard Farrell, knew I'd pronounce it wrong, who's a professor of actuarial statistics at City University in London. He's researched stochastic claims reserving for over 20 years, and this paper that he's going to discuss actually received a prize for the best paper in variance in the year 2007. His second prize, actually, from the CAS. His most well-known paper in the area was actually published in the British Actuarial Journal in 2002 with Peter England, entitled Stochastic Claims Reserving in General Insurance. Professor, thank you very much. I'm going to introduce, let me introduce Glenn, too. He's going to be providing a review and a discussion on his paper, which is published this year, Stochastic Loss Reserving with the Collective Risk Model. And this paper talks about a Bayesian approach to loss variability. Glenn, I've known for many years. He's a fellow of the Casualty Actuarial Society, a member of the Academy, and also a CERA. He's a VP and Chief Actuary at ISO Innovative Analytics. Glenn has written numerous papers, publications, and provided many, many, many presentations, some of us together, in risk and return issues and DFA, reserve variability, cost of capital allocation. He was a member of the board of directors for 3 years, and he continuously works on numerous working parties on these topics. So, Professor?
Thank you very much. The paper I'm going to present is called Obtaining Predictive Distributions for Reserves Which Incorporate Expert Opinion. It's a sort of attempt to address the problem that people often come up with, which is if you're using a stochastic model, then you can't do the sorts of things that you like to do in practice. So in practice, what you like to do is to mess around with the development parameters and so on, change things. And if you do that in a stochastic model, then what happens? How do you do it? What people quite often do is, if they're using bootstrapping, is to mess around with the residuals, change them and say, well, I'm not going to count that one, I don't like them, and so on, and I'm going to change my development factors. Of course, as soon as you do that, then all the nice theory disappears a little bit, and you don't quite know what your predictive distribution is, which is the whole point of stochastic claims reserving in the first place. So what I'm going to talk about is some of the suggestions that I put in that paper. I'm going to set it in a slightly wider context as well to discuss reserving issues in general, and also the whole issue about whether it's right to intervene in the way that you like intervening. As I said, this is based on a paper that is in variance. Most well-known paper people read is the one that I wrote with Peter England in the British Actuarial Journal in 2002. And there's another paper which has appeared in the Annals of Actuarial Science, which is, again, from the UK actuarial profession. They split their journals. They made one more scientific and called it the Annals of Actuarial Science. The British Actuarial Journal still continues, but that's more sort of professional issues. And this is a paper that Peter England and I wrote, which was published in 2006, which sort of continues on from where the 2002 paper left off. But people haven't really cottoned on to it. I don't think many people have seen it yet. It looks at predictive distributions, and I think if we'd made the title a little bit different, I think a lot more people would look at it. Because one of the things that it's got in it is bootstrapping recursive models. In other words, bootstrapping things like the Mac method, and it shows you how to do that. It also contains an introduction to Bayesian methods from quite a simplistic point of view, so I think it's fairly straightforward. And obviously, what I'm going to talk about today is Bayesian methods. In a way, Bayesian methods are similar to bootstrapping in some ways. Obviously, bootstrapping is a simulation-based method, and the way I'm going to talk about Bayesian methods, they're going to be simulation-based as well. A little bit of notation first, just so that you know what's going on and what the things are I'm talking about. I'm going to assume we've got a triangle of data, and I denote the incremental claims by Cij. It don't have to have a triangle, it just makes the notation easier as we go through. You can apply it to different shapes of data and have missing data as well. It really doesn't matter. So if you just remember that the Cijs are incremental claims, and then the Dijs are the cumulative claims, and the standard chain ladder development factors I denote by lambda j's, j going from 2 up to n. Sometimes you go from 1 to n minus 1, but this is going from 2 up to n. And the basis for the models in the paper is the over-dispersed Poisson model, which I think most people are fairly familiar with now. It basically says that incremental claims are distributed similarly to a Poisson distribution, except there's an over-dispersion parameter in there, which is called phi. And you model the log of the mean, and if you choose the model for the log of the mean in the right way, you get the same estimates as you get from the chain ladder technique. I'm going to discuss that a little bit more in a little bit more detail and why this might be a suitable model just in a moment. Now, what a lot of people concentrate on is getting the prediction error, which is basically the standard deviation of the predictive distribution. I think it's important when we're thinking about modeling and thinking about comparing models to remember that actually what we're interested in is the predictive distribution. So if you want to compare models, you have to do it on the basis of what the predictive distribution is. Are they the same? Are they different? Are the moments the same? Are they different? And so on. All that the chain ladder technique does is to get the mean of the predictive distribution, and it turns out that that's the same as the mean of the predictive distribution from the over-dispersed Poisson or from the model that Mac wrote down or from another model which I'm going to show you. So the advantage of stochastic models is that you get the prediction error as well, the second moment, but that's really only one step and it's not that interesting, I don't think. There's a lot of work done in getting, actually deriving closed forms for that prediction error. But really what we want for solvency and capital purposes is the full predictive distribution, which means that you have to look at distributions and do some analysis if you can, or if you can't, you have to simulate, bootstrap, or use some Bayesian methods. Okay, so it's just a bridge between traditional methods and stochastic methods. It gives a best estimate and a prediction error, but you need other techniques for the full predictive distribution. Now, a related model, and I'm going to try and motivate this later on, which you can get directly from the over-dispersed Poisson model, is one which is an over-dispersed negative binomial. A lot of people have trouble with the over-dispersed Poisson because the parameters don't look like the parameters of the chain ladder model. Well, actually, you can take one step towards the predicted distribution and you end up with a negative binomial model instead of a Poisson model. And it turns out that the mean has the parameters in there that you would expect from the chain ladder model. So these parameters here, these lambdas, are the ones that you would expect from the chain ladder model. And the variance also, if you think about this for a while, you'll realize that this looks like the variance of a negative binomial model, the variance you can get directly from the lambdas as well. You can see from this when the overdispersed Poisson and this model, which give exactly the same results, when these models will break down. They will break down as soon as any of these lambdas are less than one, because then the variance becomes negative. As soon as that happens, these models don't work. You can't do it. They work as long as all the lambdas are bigger than one. If they're less than one, that happens when you've got too many negative incrementals, if your data has got negative incrementals, and that's usually over on the right-hand side in the tail. So at that point, you'd say, well, I can't use this model, what am I going to do? And the obvious thing to do is to change the variance so that the lambdas don't appear in it. You'd retain the sort of structure of this. So you'd say, this has got to depend on J, I'm going to multiply it by previous cumulatives, but I'll just change this and make this phi J, where I estimate it from the data. And then I can't use the negative binomial, well, perhaps I'll use a normal model. And at that point, as soon as you do that, you have a normal approximation to this model, and that's exactly the same as the model, or the first two moments of that are exactly the same as the model that Thomas Mack derived. So in some ways, Thomas Mack's model, the way I would see it is, it's a normal approximation to this model. And when you're thinking about which models to use, obviously you need to think about the data. What's the variability in the data? Does it support either of these models? Or perhaps we should look at a different one. There's nothing special about chain ladder. It's just one that everybody's grown up with, and they pretend that it's the right one in some sense. So there we are. There's the normal approximation to the negative binomial. I've written it there for cumulative data Dij. It doesn't matter whether you use cumulatives or incrementals. Doesn't make any difference whatsoever. You can write down the same model for each. All I've done here is to change the variance, so I've just got rid of the lambda j's and put in an extra parameter or extra set of parameters that I have to estimate from the data, and at this point this is gives exactly the same results as the Mack model. So when you're doing bootstrapping isn't a model, it's a technique for getting estimation error. People often think, well, bootstrapping, that's a model, and it means using the overdispersed Poisson. It doesn't. You can bootstrap any model you like by defining and fitting the model, obtaining the residuals, resample, get pseudo data, fit the model to pseudo data, and do that lots and lots of times. And as long as you do the third step of including the process error down here, you will get the prediction errors in your final step. And you can bootstrap any model. I can do this one, which will give me the same results as Mack. I can do the overdispersed negative binomial. I can do the overdispersed Poisson. Bootstrapping is a method for getting towards the predictive distribution. And it's this process which is summarized in the paper that I mentioned in the first slide. Now, why should the overdispersed Poisson be any good? I think we're getting to the stage now where people are accepting stochastic methods. I think it's partly they've been forced to by regulators, but we've got to that stage, and we can now go down two different routes. We can either say, okay, well, I have to use them. I like the chain ladder. I think I understand it. I'm sure it's right. So let me just put a stochastic model on that and look at the results. Or you can go down the other route and say, well, I want to think about the mechanisms generating the data. I want to try and understand what's going on and do a proper modeling approach on that and see what the results look like as a statistician. Each has advantages. Obviously, if you've got time and you want to do a proper detailed statistical analysis, then the second approach is better. But quite often, you have to have a method that's easy to implement, which you can do throughout a company, for example, and get consistent results. You don't want it to be too complicated. You have to explain it to people, and then the simplistic method has advantages. What I've been working on recently is somewhere in between the two, where you start thinking about what's generating the data, what the mechanisms are generating the data, and you work up towards a model, and then you simplify it so that it's easy to understand and you can justify it, and you can apply it to readily available data. So you don't have to have loads and loads of data at the individual level or anything like that. You can just do it on the standard data. You may not end up with the chain ladder technique, but there's nothing special about the chain ladder technique. It's just one model. In fact, in some ways, it's hardly a model at all. It's about the least modeling model you could think of. It's got one parameter for each row, one parameter for each column. It doesn't specify a runoff pattern. All it says is the runoff pattern is the same in each year. And then, of course, we know that you don't believe that, because then you go and change the runoff patterns in each year anyway. But it's hardly a model there at all. There are two parts to a model. One is the distributional assumptions, and the other is how you would model a mean. And if you're thinking about the distributional assumptions, I think it's quite good to go back to basic assumptions and think about basic risk theory. And this is something that was first done as a very, very basic general model for claim payments by Ragnar Norberg about 20 years ago. He's now at the London School of Economics as a Norwegian actuary. Looking at the basic process, as you would do when you were studying risk theory in your early exams. And the sorts of things you do is to think about individual claims, XIJs, or individual payments, and the number of individual payments, NIJ. And you'd end up with a compound Poisson process, because you might well say that NIJ has got a Poisson distribution, and then the entry of any point in the triangle for incrementals, CIJ, is a random sum. So it's a sum of a random number of random variables. And this is something that you're all familiar with from your examinations. And it's easy to derive the mean and variance of CIJ. Now, as soon as you start putting distributional assumptions on these, you get a little bit further with these. And the standard sorts of distributional assumptions you'd make are that N would have a Poisson distribution. Maybe you put over dispersed Poisson if you thought it was a bit more like a negative binomial. But let's just assume we've got a Poisson. No, I'm going to put an over dispersed Poisson. And then for the claim sizes or the payment sizes, well, the first thing you do is to start with a simple assumption like a gamma distribution. Of course, you might say, oh, I need a heavier tailed one and things like that, but that's fine. But let's just start simple at the moment. And that just means that basically the variance of N is proportional to the mean of N. That's a Poisson type model. And for the payments, the variance of the payments is proportional to the mean of the payments squared. And those are basic assumptions that you might make. Now, if you then go and substitute those all in, and I'm sure you would have done this kind of thing during your examinations, you end up that the variance of incremental payments looks like this. And this is the mean of incremental payments. So what this says is that the variance is proportional to the mean. There's two interesting things about this. First of all, it says that the variance of incremental payments should be proportional to the mean, which supports an over-dispersed Poisson modeling structure. And the second thing is that when we use the over-dispersed Poisson, very often you just have phi being constant there. And that's never going to work in practice, because if you look at this, phi is actually this thing here, and it depends on the expected payment size at any point. And that's not going to be constant over the triangle. So the over-dispersed Poisson modeling assumption is that the variance is proportional to the mean, and that's supported by the underlying risk theory. But the constant of proportionality is never going to be constant in practice, and if you just use the over-dispersed Poisson in its standard form, the results won't be any good at all. So what can you do about it? Well, the obvious thing to do is to model phi ij. And you can actually simplify this a little bit and get it working quite well, because remember that phi ij is related to the expected payment size, and that is going to vary a lot with development period, but it may not vary quite so much by accident year. So a simplifying assumption is just to have the phi ij equal to phi j and just have it depending on development period. If you can model the phi j's, this begins to look in some ways a bit like what Thomas Mack did with having a separate variance parameter in each column that you estimate from the data. And you can model those, and if you do that, you get much more credible results. It's quite easy to incorporate this into the modeling, into bootstrapping or anything like that, and it works a lot better. The other sorts of things you might think about doing are saying, well, okay, I've just written down some modeling assumptions for my basic variables. In other words, the numbers, claim frequency, and the claim payments. Can you take that any further? Can you think about this in any more detail? Can you model payment numbers and amounts separately if they're available? If they're not, can you write down some models that you think will be suitable for the type of data you're seeing, and then work through and see what the distribution of the CIJs might look like? And there's lots of things you can do there. One of them is the so-called Hurl curve, which is a gamma runoff shape, which is a lot stronger assumption than the chain ladder model. There's plenty of things you can do with that. Now, a little bit of maths, just to go back and to think about what we're trying to do and think about this predictive distribution. The predictive distribution is the distribution of a future amount given the data that you've got. And I find the easiest way to think about that is in a sort of Bayesian way, which is to say that you would look at the distribution of a future amount given the parameters, and then you'd say, well, I've got to estimate the parameters from the data, I'll get the posterior distribution of the parameters from the data, and then integrate over the parameters in order to get this predictive distribution. So this is a bit of standard statistical theory. To get the distribution of this given that, you get the distribution of this given these things, multiply by the distribution of these given that, and integrate. And it's crucial how you do this. And it's very important for us to understand this if we're thinking about, for example, Bornhutter-Ferguson. Because you have choices here. And some of them will give you one result, and some of them will give you another result. And the crucial thing is which parameters you estimate first, or do you estimate them all together? If you estimate them all together, and you just put a vague prior on the parameters, and you have a Poisson or an overdispersed Poisson distribution here, you get the overdispersed Poisson model. However, it looks like chain ladder doesn't estimate any row parameters, any xi's. Xi's are in the rows, and yj's are in the columns. So let's see if we can do that estimation first. So let's have a look and let's do the estimation of the row parameters, the xi's, first. And then once we've got this distribution, we can do the distribution of the column parameters afterwards, estimate those second. Okay, so you're going to do this in a particular order. Now, if you look at this distribution here, this is a sort of partial predictive distribution because we're pretending that we know the column parameters, which will be like the development parameters. And we're looking at this distribution saying, okay, let's estimate the row parameters first in this overdispersed Poisson model. And actually, if you do that and you look at this distribution, you get an overdispersed negative binomial model, which is the one I mentioned earlier. And that's what you then get is that you've done one part of the overall estimation, and then you have to do the next bit, which is to estimate the lambdas and get the predicted distribution having estimated these as well. And it's sort of hidden from you when you're doing chain ladder because there's a very obvious way of estimating where each row is, and that's just to use the latest diagonal. Of course, you are doing an estimation there. You don't really realize it, but if I just give you development factors, you couldn't come up with a reserve. You need to know what the paid to date is in order to get the reserve. So the estimate for the row is actually equal to the paid to date. How would you intervene into this? Well, we've got this nice negative binomial model with lambdas in there, and we have a whole amount of flexibility about what we do with these lambdas. And if you work within the Bayesian setting, you can, we'll miss that one out, you can mess around with those lambdas, and in the paper I showed you in quite a lot of detail how to implement that in a free piece of software which is called Bugs or WinBugs, which is designed to make the application of Bayesian modelling as simple as possible. And you can do lots of things, use only part of the data, assume the runoff pattern changes, intervene in a particular parameter, and as long as you believe your prior distributions that you put in there, then you will get the predictive distribution at the end. So these are the things you can do. You could intervene, but you will have to be honest about your intervention there, and you will have to say, I've got a very strong prior distribution and it says that I know what this parameter is and I'm going to ignore the data. And I think that's a bit more honest, and I think it's something that maybe the regulators will start thinking about as well. You know, if you're doing all this intervention, that means that you're saying you know better than the data about what's going on. You may be right. Sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong. But I think there needs to be some sort of honesty in the process. And I think that the Bayesian way of thinking about it does give you that transparency and honesty. The second thing that you can do is to do Bornhutter-Ferguson, which is again an intervention. And this time what this is saying is that instead of using the paid to date, I'm going to change that and use a different number. So all you need from chain ladder are the development factors. And once you've got your initial estimate of ultimate claims, you can get a paid to date or an implied paid to date, which you can use instead of the actual one from the data. So you would estimate the proportion of ultimate claims that are outstanding for each accident year using the chain ladder development factors, and then you apply these to your initial estimate of ultimate claims. That's the way Bornhutter-Ferguson works. So in effect, what we're doing is we're changing our estimates of the row parameters, the XIs. Instead of having something which depends on the data here, you're inserting your own estimate of what the ultimate claim should be. In effect, what you do is you say, okay, here's my estimate of ultimate claims. I'll bring that back to the latest diagonal by dividing by a set of development factors to bring it back from the end down to the latest diagonal. And then this replaces, well, I would call it di n minus I plus 1. That's the cumulative claims in the latest diagonal. And you get the reserve by multiplying by development factors minus 1. So if you're doing chain ladder, here you'd have the latest cumulative claims in the triangle. Bornhutter-Ferguson says chuck that away and use this. Now, if you're doing that as a Bayesian, then you'd say, well, actually what I'm doing here is putting a prior distribution on the XIs. And then you can work out what the distribution of the predictive distribution is using this prior distribution, and you end up with something where the mean looks like this, and I'm going to develop this a little bit further. It looks a little bit like a credibility mean, and actually if you do a little bit more work on it, you can see that the mean for the next incrementals looks rather like a chain ladder mean. In other words, the mean for an incremental will be previous cumulative, under the chain ladder, will be previous cumulative times lambda j minus 1. For the next cumulative, you just multiply by lambda j. For the next incremental, you multiply by lambda j minus 1. So if we put z equals 1, then we just have previous cumulatives there. If we put z equals 0, then this one is 1, and you've got this thing here. This is the mean of that gamma distribution for the xi, so this takes the place of mi, and then this is bringing it back to the latest diagonal. So this bit here is the equivalent of this thing here. So this is the Bornhutter-Ferguson thing, and what you've got there is some balance between them, where you have chain ladder if the z's are 1, and you have Bornhutter-Ferguson if the z's are 0, and you can go all the way between them. Notice that actually Bornhutter-Ferguson is quite arrogant as a method, and it says, put the z's as 0. The data don't tell me anything. I'm just going to use my estimate because I know I'm right. Chuck it all away. I would say that perhaps you should be a little bit less arrogant about it and say, well, perhaps the data have got a little bit to tell me, and I won't have a completely well-specified prior distribution. I will allow the data to come in a little bit. Actually, it's interesting when you're modeling Bornhutter-Ferguson, because what you want to do is to use the chain ladder development factors. That's what Bornhutter-Ferguson does. And actually, if you simply put a prior distribution for the xi's on here, for the row parameters, that will change the estimates of the column parameters, the development factors. It makes sense if you think about it, if you think about what you're doing and you say, okay, I'm changing what I think the final ones are going to be, well, that must change off the runoff in some way. And so it must change the development factors. But Bornhutter-Ferguson method actually uses the lambdas from the chain ladder. So if you want to reproduce that, what you have to do is to estimate those first before you start putting in your prior distribution on the row parameters. So it's like the one I did earlier, but it's the other way around. Instead of estimating the row parameters first, I've got to estimate the column parameters first. They will be the chain ladder development factors. I get the predictive distribution for future observations, but I still need to estimate the row parameters, the xi's, and that's where I can put in my Bornhutter-Ferguson observations, assumptions. And it turns out that, again, you get an overdispersed negative binomial, the same as chain ladder, except it's all a bit different. Chain ladder goes across from column to column, and actually this is the same as chain ladder, but it goes down. And you might think, well, chain ladder is a model, but it's not a model. It's just a technique for filling in the bottom triangle. So here is a set of data. These are incremental claims, and you know how to do chain ladder. What you do is you calculate cumulative claims, cumulating across this way. You get column sums of cumulatives. You divide one column sum by the previous column sum to get development factors. This is standard chain ladder. You then take the final diagonal and you start multiplying by development factors to go across this way. This gives you, fills in this bit here with cumulative claims. And if you take first differences, then you get your predictions of incremental claims, and these are the chain ladder numbers and the chain ladder reserve. It's just a way of filling in these numbers. You don't have to do it like that. You can do it the other way around if you like. So here are my incrementals. I'm going to calculate cumulatives, but this time I'm going to accumulate down this way. So this one here is previous cumulative plus that incremental. Okay, so it's going downwards. I can then calculate chain ladder development factors going down this way by adding up across each row, and I get development factors here, which tell me how much these change by as you go down this way. I can then take the latest diagonal and multiply by development factors to go down to give me cumulative claims going down downwards. If I then take first differences going downwards, I get predictions of future incrementals which are exactly the same as the ones I had earlier. So here's the ones, here are the chain ladder reserves going the other way around. And here are the chain ladder reserves going the standard way around. So they're exactly the same. So if you start saying, well, you know, chain ladder model tells me what the development factors are and those make sense. Well, you could think about that as development factors going down this way, if you like, which is what I mean when I say it's hardly really a model. Now, what we want to do is to use this form of the chain ladder model going downwards, because then that leaves me with parameters for each row, which are in the format of development factors. And it's those parameters going down that way, these gamma i's, to which I can apply a prior distribution. Actually, I want to do it to the xi's rather than the gamma i's, but I can apply it to xi's and then derive what the gamma i's here through slightly complicated formula, but you can do this in a spreadsheet if you want to. And then work out what the posterior distribution is. Now, if you do that, if you say, okay, I want to do Bornhutter-Ferguson exactly, then you'd say, well, the prior distribution has got to have variance zero, because I know what these parameters should be. That's what Bornhutter-Ferguson says. And here are the Bornhutter-Ferguson reserves, and here are the numbers from the Bayesian model with an exact prior, and these numbers are, well, they've been rounded by wind bugs a little bit. They're based on, it's a simulation-based method, but to all intents and purposes, they're the same numbers as you get out here. The advantage of this is that you then get the prediction error, or the full predictive distribution if you want it, and the Bayesian prediction error as a percentage of the reserve. This is under the assumption that you know what those row parameters should be. As I said, you can go anywhere between chain ladder estimates and Bornhutter-Ferguson estimates using the Bayesian model. And perhaps it would be better to be a little bit less sure about yourselves and not use Bornhutter-Ferguson exactly, but say, okay, let's use the data a little bit as well and go somewhere in between. The result is that you'll get a slightly higher prediction error. So Bornhutter-Ferguson prediction errors will be generally too small in practice. But if you allow the data to come in as well, you get a number here. This Bayesian reserve is somewhere in between Bornhutter-Ferguson and the chain ladder reserve, and you get the prediction errors as well. So just to conclude, Bayesian methods are fairly flexible. Some ways you've got to you have to do a little bit more work to control them, but they're pretty flexible. They're as easy to apply as bootstrapping. You can use expert opinion, and you can do Bornhutter-Ferguson. Thank you.
Okay, I should say right here that I actually was reading Richard's paper as I was writing this one, and, so which is why I thought it would be, you know, logical for me to go afterwards. Now, what I'm going to do right here is I'm going to start off. I'm not going to talk about the paper directly, but I do notice right here that I know at our last meeting we had an interesting little debate right there of stochastic versus deterministic methods. And I also noticed that I think at the latest GIRO meeting, they also had another session that was debating the issue of stochastic versus deterministic methods. And I thought that what I would like to do first is just talk a little bit about my general approach to stochastic modeling applied to some simpler models first, because loss reserve models are very complex models. And then after I talk a little bit about the approach with a couple of examples to stochastic modeling, okay, and my argument for it, then I'm going to actually move into the paper itself. Now, I'm going to consider just an example right here. Suppose you have some x's that have a log normal distribution with a certain mu of 5 and a sigma of 2. Now, you suppose you're just given the data, and you don't know the mu or the sigma. Now, there are two ways right here that you can estimate the expected value of x, which according to what we have here is, you know, 1,097. You can do essentially the simple way, which is just simply take the sample mean. Okay? Now, the second way you can do this is you can take the log of the x's, take its sample mean, find out the sample standard deviation, and then basically use the formula that we all know for the mean of the log normal. So you got the question right here, which one of these is the better estimator? Well, again, we got the arguments right there. We got the simple versus the complicated. Well, so what do we do? What we do is there's an awful lot of mathematical theory that does this, but to illustrate the point, I think it's better illustrated with a simulation. So I took a sample size of 500, and I took 200 samples and calculated the sample mean for each one of these things. Okay, and let's look at the variability for each estimator. Okay, so you can see up here at the top, whoops, wait a minute. Okay, I went this way. Okay, you look at the top thing right there, and so what you're seeing right here is this is the histogram of the straight average. And what you can see right here, it is much wider than the histogram that you get from taking the log normal average. The range is smaller, the maximum smaller, so we get a much better estimate of the mean using the more complicated log normal formula. Okay, and so the lessons from this right here is knowing something about the distribution of the observations can lead to a better estimate of the mean. Okay, so to my mind right there, this is probably the best argument you can give for stochastic modeling, even if you're not interested in, okay, the variance of the result. Okay. Now, actuaries have sort of known this. I always look in history as to what people have done. And whenever they see these things, they use what we call robust statistics. They knock out outliers. They use cap means and everything like that. So actuaries have sort of known this, and they've been adjusting it accordingly. And this is essentially as a formalization of the arguments that we see actuaries traditionally doing. Okay, now I think also you might notice that this is probably why, right there, as we move over to the generalized linear model, which takes into account the distribution of the observations, that's why we're not doing the old simple linear modeling, you know, that are what SAS called GLM, you know, based on the normal distribution. Okay, now the next theme I want to get into right there is what's getting to be called Markov chain Monte Carlo methods, okay? And we saw Richard didn't talk a whole lot about it, but he certainly made use of these methods in his paper. He used something called the Gibbs sampler through a program called WinBugs, and actually the first version of this paper, it actually used the Gibbs sampler. And in the second version that I wrote after I got the first review from the reviewers of this paper was I switched over to something called the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm. Which version of the MCMC methods, I'm not sure I've converged on, shall I say, the right answer yet. That's a very complicated question. There are very many ways to do this. But what these Monte Carlo Markov chain methods do right there is it randomly generates parameters in proportion to the posterior probabilities. Now, let me sort of give my view of this. Now, I wrote an article in the Actuarial Review last year that sort of talked about the Gibbs sampler. And the idea right there, suppose you're trying to estimate the parameters of a log normal. Okay? Now, what happens right there is you have a prior distribution sort of represented right here by a bunch of mu's and sigmas like that. And now what you do is you show it some data. And what the showing the data actually does right here is it reduces the variability, okay, of the initial log normal parameters to something that is much more compact. So that way what we're doing is the Bayesian view of this is you use data to reduce the uncertainty in your estimates. Okay, and so the next thing I want to say right here is that, so we get a posterior distribution of, say, a mu and a sigma from a log normal distribution. Now, we're not interested in that, per se. Okay, what we're interested in is some function of the parameters. Okay, and what I did right there was I actually took something which we call the limited expected value. And the idea right here is over to the side, what we have are mu's and sigmas that sort of pop out of the Gibbs sample. It was part of the samples from the posterior distribution. And then what you do is you calculate what we call, a statistics called the layer expected value. Okay, and for each of the parameters that pop out of there. Now over here, what we see is the histogram of values that you get for the layer expected value from the prior distribution. And here you can see how essentially after you expose it to the data, you get a posterior distribution of the layer expected value. Okay, these are all fairly simple, you know, calculations. You get your posterior distribution of your parameters, you take the function, you apply that to each parameter set, you get a distribution of what I will call a statistic of interest. Okay. Now, so the evolving strategy that we've had right here for modeling uncertainty is, of course, we got point estimates. You could either say the maximum likelihood estimator or the Bayesian predictive mean. But then what we got right there, the ranges, which of we call Bayesian ranges, and you basically get what we call quantities of interest, okay, or statistics of interest, weighted by the posterior probability of the parameters that develop these things. Now, unlike Richard, I've only been doing loss reserve in any big way for only about, I started about 5 years ago. It's when I've been sort of following it from then, but my history is more of a distribution fitter, aggregate loss calculator, that kind of thing, and going on to a lot of this business with enterprise risk management. And, I've applied this sort of stuff right there for, like, claim severity models. I've been doing this for quite some time. And then I said, okay, let's start going into loss reserve models, okay? And the thing that sort of piqued my interest in the whole thing was the old S&P report, okay, where basically what they said right there was that actuaries are signing off on reserves that turn to be wildly inaccurate. Okay, I've always been a little gun shy of loss reserving. Not so much that I didn't appreciate the problem, but it's more one of there is an awful lot of pressures for you to move results one way or another. Yeah, okay. And, and I've really, I said, I'm not sure that, I was in a strong enough position to start playing that game, okay? And so at this point right there, as I get well into my 50s, and I say, okay, let's give this a shot. Now, the one thing I want to say right here is that I fully understand the difficulties in setting loss reserves, but I want to really define the way I'm doing this. I'm treating it as a statistical problem, okay, and recognizing that there are a lot of other problems that are involved here. Now, I've been at this for a couple years now, and actually I've turned out a couple papers already. I'll mention two of them. One of them is the Estimating Predictive Distributions for Loss Reserve Models that actually appeared in the 2000 issue of Variance. Now, what I was interested in this one right there was basically how do you know you've got a good fit? I would describe myself as an aggressive back tester. So what I did in that paper was I tried it with some triangles, held out some data, saw how it went. Okay? And for this right there, what you need is the full predictive distribution. Okay? And I think I'm total agreement with Richard right there for reasons like solvency 2, et cetera, but also just simply for testing models. You need to predict a distribution. Okay? Now, another one right here was that I wrote a paper for the 2000 Aston Colloquium, something called Thinking Outside the Triangle. And essentially what it did right there was it showed that a maximum likelihood estimate, and you tried, if you estimate the full parameters with a maximum likelihood estimate, you systematically underestimate the variance. Okay? And I've actually got a little bit more. This was done by simulation and examples with loss reserve models, but I've actually got at this point some, you know, more academic type justification for that. Okay, so that's one of the things that's coming out there. And the way to correct for the systematic underestimation is you got to go Bayes. Okay, now moving on right there. This, I should say right here, this paper was really intended to be a what I would call a how-to-do-it paper, okay? In other words, the first papers that I had, you know, were basically is what I had to do to sort out my own mind and how to, you know, deal with these things. But at some point right there, if these methods are going to take off, there's got to be something that says, okay, how are the actuaries that I know, okay, going to be able to do this sort of thing, okay? Now, the other thing right here is that, like I said, I'm sort of a diehard Bayesian, and I want to illustrate what I call my current favorite tools. And this is evolving. Between the first version of this paper and the second version of the paper, you know, I'm changing my mind as I move along here. But at some point, you got to do a paper. So this is what I would call my current favorite methodology. Okay, we're going to illustrate this method on a data set. And here is a data set. We've got the part of the triangle that has numbers in it. Then you've got the lower part of the triangle that has random variables that you have to be estimating. Okay, now the plan of attack right here is we want to specify the stochastic model needed to calculate the likelihood of the data. Okay, now once you got that stochastic models, you can do things like calculate maximum likelihood estimators, and then you can generate a series of parameters from the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm. Now, then once you get that, you want to get what we call the quantity of interest, which is going to be, in this case, I'll have a couple different quantities of interest as we move on, but the main one I'm after is the distribution of the outcomes. Okay, this is the full predictive distribution that Richard referred to. Okay, now for the models for the expected loss right there, I want to illustrate a little bit of flexibility, so I chose two models. Okay, and my data right here is going to be incremental paid losses. Okay, so the first one is I'm going to call, which is the what I call the independent factor model. I tried calling it Cape Cod, because we were estimating the ELRs, but the referees wouldn't let me, so that went away. So I call it the independent factor model, where the expected loss is going to be the premium, which depends upon the accident year, the expected loss ratio, which depends upon the accident year, and a development factor. It's an incremental paid incremental development factor, which depends upon the settlement lag. Now, what happens right here is that you may want to actually use some kind of a formula, okay, that generates the settlement lag right here. And so what I did right there was I tried one where the settlement lag is sort of based off percentiles of the beta distribution. Okay? Now, what we're going to be doing right here is we're going to be estimating these expected loss ratios and the development, you know, factors. Or if they're coming from the beta distribution, the A and B parameters of the beta distribution, those are going to be actually estimated from the data. Okay? The model itself, right here, is going to be the collective risk model. Okay? And again, right there, it's going to be a compound Poisson model, where what we do is we develop the we basically grab a random claim count from a Poisson distribution. Then from each claim count, what you do is you grab a random claim amount. Okay? Now, you know, it's my first papers were actually starting in 1980. Okay, we're dealing with these kind of things. Okay, now for the distribution that we use in the collective risk model is that working at ISO, I have access to a lot of distributions. And the first ones actually used real-life distributions that I had access to at ISO. But when they said, I want to write a paper that really bears everything, ISO says, can you use something else that's sort of like that, not really ours? And so that's what I did. I used a Pareto distribution with a shape parameter of 2. And what I did right there is I varied the scale parameter, increasing the scale parameter as we went up to by settlement lag. This really comes along with the idea that basically it's small claims that settle early, large claims that settle later. It sort of goes along with that intuition, and it is certainly backed up with the kind of data that I have access to at ISO. Now, the trouble right here is that to calculate the likelihood for this, I can do wonderful things with Fourier transforms. And to calculate these aggregate loss distributions, likelihood from a collective risk model. And I found out that that takes a lot of time, especially when you see when I get to the Markov chain Monte Carlo methods. I mean, I don't think a lot of people are going to be patient enough to let these things run through. I've let a couple of these run through for weeks. Okay? So what I needed to do right here is I wanted to use something that I could do a little quicker, okay? And believe it or not, the first version of this paper used the overdispersed negative binomial, right there, to approximate the likelihood. And then lately, I went on with something called the Tweedy distribution, okay? And essentially what I did right there was I said, okay, use the Pareto and the Poisson to get the moments, find the Tweedy distribution where the severity distribution underlying the Tweedy actually matches the moments of the severity. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the Tweedy, okay? The Tweedy itself, okay, has a very nice description, has the collective risk model, okay? Essentially, what it boils down to is that the claim count is Poisson, and the claim severity is gamma, and it is a distribution of the aggregate losses, okay? Now, you can actually take the parameters of your gamma and your Poisson and turn that into what is being called the traditional parameters of the Tweedy, which is the mean. It has a p parameter, okay, and it has a dispersion parameter. Now, this is quite often used in the generalized linear model setting right there, but the generalized linear models want the dispersion parameter to be constant, okay, and we decide we don't want that, okay, so we had to sort of move into calculating, okay, the likelihood function, okay, using, and I did this stuff in R, and they have a Tweedy package, and they have a nice little function called dTweedy, where you can actually collapse and calculate the likelihood of your model. Now, I should point out right here that the dTweedy, if you take a look at how it's calculating right there, I would look at some of the Dunn and Smith papers. But in the end, they're using Fourier transforms again. Okay? And I decided that, okay, that's still a little slow. And actually, I started looking into the details as to how they got this. And I found a shortcut. And that shortcut, I actually described it last Monday in one of the concurrent sessions. And I'll say, for this talk, just look in Appendix B. Okay, so there is something, but it really boils down to using the Tweedy package and the dTweedy. It's just that you have to rearrange the calculations in such a way that you can do the stuff that takes time only once. Okay, so what you can do right there is you've got a likelihood function. R has a couple of programs. I happen to use Optim, which is sort of like Excel Solver. You can say, I want to maximize this. So I tell it maximize likelihood, and I actually get parameters for the ELRs, the expected loss ratios, and the developments, or I can do it indirectly with the beta model. Okay, so this is a doable thing. Okay, now, next thing I want to do is introduce what we call Markov chain Monte Carlo methods. Okay, so the idea right there is that you consider a chain of random vectors where essentially to get to the succeeding vector, it is an operator on the preceding random vector. Now, what happens is that if you run these Markov chains for many, many steps, what you get right there is a sequence of basically your parameters that we're after. And what happens is that if you ignore the initial ones, you're going to get them actually following, okay, the posterior distribution. Okay? That depends upon the choice of the operator H, and of course that's where the issue arises in here. There's one of the operators is something called the Gibbs sampler. Another operator is called the Metropolis Hastings. One of the sessions that I wanted to go to gave any more versions of the Markov chain Monte Carlo methods. And like I said, I thought the Metropolis Hastings was vastly superior to the Gibbs in this application. But you know, I'm still a little open on that issue. Okay, let's describe a little bit about what the Metropolis Hastings algorithm does. Okay, what it does right there is you select a candidate value from some sort of distribution. That's what I would call sort of, they call a proposal density kind of thing. And then what you do is you get a ratio right here that the F and G is really your posterior distribution for the thing you selected. Okay, and then you then the denominator is the posterior distribution that you had before. Then you have a sort of a correction factor because of the, if you have an asymmetric proposal density distribution, okay? And so what you do right there is you select a uniform random number, and if it's less than R, you say, okay, I'll accept it. And if it's not, use the same one you used before. And you just simply run the sequence off for as often as you could, okay? Now, what happens right here is I actually did this for a single dimensional example. I actually have them for the entire set of parameters that I use for the loss development. And you can see that if you let your proposal density be not terribly variable, what it is right there is you can sort of tune the proposal density so that you can make your steps big or small, okay? And if you make them too small, what you see is a fair amount of autocorrelation, okay, between the results. And if you make them, you know, too big, if you make it too variable, quite often, you know, you reject it a lot. You reject these things a lot of times. And here's one that I consider to be just right, what they call a trace plot of the Metropolis. This is actually a sequence of the posterior parameters that are generated by the Metropolis Hastings algorithm. And so they have some guidelines that I think right now I would sort of regard as rules of thumb about, you know, what a proper acceptance rate is. Okay, and, oh boy, we lose a little bit of math here. Okay. But anyhow, what we did right there is we're actually applying the Metropolis Hastings vectors to the entire set of expected loss ratios and to the, you know, the development factors. So we got a lot of parameters running around here. Okay, this, what I need to do right here is specify the prior distributions that I'm using, Now, this is this. I used a second paper. This data that we have here actually resembles, I would say, U.S. commercial auto data. Okay, and the paper I did in the 2007 variants also was done with that. And what I did in that paper was I estimated by maximum likelihood, okay, about a large number of insurers. And so I took a look at the parameters that sort of came from the large numbers of insurers, and I said, okay, how are these parameters spread about? And I said, okay, let's use those right there to generate the prior. Okay, and so here are the priors I came up with. These little squares should be something that says the ELR is distributed as. Okay, so what we have are, you know, basically posterior prior parameters. Okay, and I was able to do this with a beta distribution, but I also did this with each for the independent factor model. I actually came up with priors that actually represent, you know, the data I saw from MLEs of a large number of insurers from prior information. I just did that because I wanted the examples to be sort of realistic. When you select priors, you got to do a lot of hard thinking. Be transparent and honest, I think are the words. I like that. Okay. Now, the kind of things that sort of came out of the Metropolis Hastings is that you see quite often right there is I just took a sequence, you know, somewhere in the list of, I think, 26,000 runs of this. Okay. So you can see that quite often, if you can see these, that they only change about, I think, 25% of the time. You know, they change, which is the recommended acceptance rate for Metropolis Hastings. And so what you see, a lot of these things are sort of being repeated, but then every now and then they change. That's the kind of output you get from the set of parameters. Now, what I did right there was I ran this thing for, I think, 26,000 iterations, tossed out the first 1,000, and I said, okay, things seem to be converging just from looking at trace plots and so forth. And then what I did right there, as perhaps being a little careful, is I just took 1,000 of them at random from anywhere between the thousandths and the 26,000ths iteration, okay? That way, I felt I had a pretty good representation. I didn't need to worry too much about autocorrelation or anything like that. I might point out right here is that when I did the Gibbs sampler thing of this, it took about 2 hours to get, it took about 2 hours right here to get the, you know, the 500 iterations. It took 5 minutes to get 26,000 iterations with the Metropolis Hastings. Right now, I'm pro Metropolis Hastings. Right now. Okay. So, anyhow, so there we go. Now, one thing right there is I like to look at the Bayesian estimations right here has essentially a narrowing of the range of parameters. So what I did right here was in this upper left-hand graph, I plotted a sample of 500 expected loss ratio paths. Okay. Now what happened is after I took a look at the data I had and I narrowed those things, you can see how I narrowed the paths quite a bit. There's still some uncertainty there. Okay? Same thing for the loss development patterns. We started off with the 500, I took a sample of 500 paths. Then I said, okay, let's take a look at what happens after I apply, okay, the Metropolis Hastings algorithm. So what we're seeing right there is the data narrowing the range of outcomes, which is what we are really after. Okay. Now, let's get to statistics of interest. I would say the one I'm most interested in right there is the predictive distribution of reserve outcomes, okay? But, you know, and as I talk with people, they say there's an awful lot of people that want to get the distribution of estimates, okay? And, you know, since I wanted to compare with others, myself, I tend to think it's a little useless. I like to take a look at things I can check out, check. Okay, and solvency two is also want to get the distribution of outcomes. But anyhow, I did them both. So one of the things is what I'll call right there to make this look like the common parlance, the range of reasonable estimates. And so essentially what I did is I just took the parameters that popped out of the posterior distribution right there and just simply basically added up the estimates for all the estimates of the expected values. That's what we get here. So essentially what this is the range of predicted expected values. Okay, then the other thing, what I did right here, was I wanted to get the range of predictive distribution, and I'll talk a little bit about that. First of all, let's take a look at what we call the range of reasonable estimates. I've got 1,000 of them there. I calculate, multiply my ELR and my dev factor, add them all up for the lower triangle, get a histogram of these things. And you can see right here that for this, the range goes anywhere between 60,000 and maybe 75,000, like that, okay? And they're very similar for the beta model. Okay, now what let's do is let's get the statistics of interest for reserve outcomes. Okay, we use the collective risk model, and here I went back to the Pareto distributions. Okay, now there's two ways to do this. One way you can basically go through and go to your list of parameters and basically pick out your set of ELR parameters and your development factor parameters, okay, basically, and then simulate. You say, okay, we've got an expected loss here. We have a severity distribution. Go grab a random number of claims for each cell and go grab a random number of, claim amounts for each cell, add everything up and add up across all the cells. This is a simulation that I suspect many people might even do. Simulation is pretty fast these days, okay? Now, what I did here is that probably because of my history and I like things going speedy, I use fast Fourier transforms, okay? I'm not gonna go through the fast Fourier transform math here, but it is doable, and I actually have the code for it in the appendix of the paper, okay? But the idea right here is with the fast Fourier transform, you can actually calculate right here the predictive distribution of outcomes. Okay, and it turned out that for the independent factor model and the beta model that we got very similar results. Now I might point out right here, okay, that when I actually created that triangle that I used right there, I actually simulated data from a beta model. What I found a little surprising here, and I'm not sure I've completely resolved it in my own mind, was that with independent factor model, you've got about, 8 more parameters. Okay, and you'd think you would get a somewhat wider predictive distribution. I didn't. I'm a little surprised, but, I'm going with it anyway. And, there's some mathematical investigations to be done here. Now, that's pretty much ends the paper right here, is that I'm not done. I'll tell you the kind of things that I'm thinking about right now. A couple things right there is that right now I did this on incremental paid data. I've always sort of believed in paid data because I trust data that involves money changing hands and I trust the auditing process. Okay, when money doesn't change hands, things get a little bit less reliable. I actually recall from the last month's CLRS, Ben Zenworth made a comment that I found intriguing, that he said that basically incurred data actually lags paid data. I'm gonna check that one out. But anyhow, the idea right there is the argument given for incurred data is that it's ahead of it. But like I said, this is a statistical question that can't be resolved. And there's data available to do this. Okay, but at the same time right there, if I'm sitting there trying to apply this, I did this with commercial auto, which is by and large paid out after 10 years. Okay, if you're sitting there with a GL line and you see that the paid data is about half the incurred data, I can't ignore that. So I'm looking at the Munich chain ladder type things and seeing where we can go from there. Okay. Now, the other thing I did in my 2007 paper was I actually did testing of predictive distributions on subsequent development. The idea behind that was percentiles are uniformly distributed. That's testable. And so we do it, okay? And then, of course, the idea is getting the distribution isn't the end right there. We want to apply the results to things like solvency too. And I've still got that in my mind. And so that's where I'm headed. I certainly would be interested in talking with other people who are headed in the same direction right there. This is a lot of work, and I do have a day job. Okay. So anyhow, that's kind of what it is, and I think that's the end, and I think we got time for some questions.
Thank you, Glenn, Professor. We can take questions. Yep.
No, the prior distribution for the parameters was the conjugate prior, which is a gamma. For the incrementals, I was using over-dispersed Poisson.
I mean, the development of the model was based on the gamma distribution.
No, the distribution of the data is over-dispersed Poisson, and the conjugate prior for that is a gamma prior.
The A's and B's are independent of accident year, that's right. And, I may change that when we actually get to retrospective tests, but so far it seems to work pretty well.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that would be justified, another justification for something
with the data, because then,
the
adoption of variable. Yeah. The ELRs do vary by accident year. This model, yeah, but when I justify things, I like to justify by retrospective testing. That's the way I justified. The assumptions by themselves are, they're wrong. All models are wrong. Some are useful. The usefulness is something to be tested.
Yes, sir.
It's like a comment. In practice, one of the first things you do is you assume your history is not a stationary distribution. And pretty much all of the papers, in all of my years, they're always assuming that the statistics people assume that the thing is stationary. What would be really more valuable is to identify the lack of stationary. For example, in the commercial auto case, you could change this in the law.
Okay, Let me take that one. First of all, changes in severity. Perhaps that's one of the reasons that, you know, I like using, okay, a collective risk model where we can actually change the, you know, you use the model to fit the data. You may want to deploy it to something else if you know that there's changes going on. Okay, now the other thing I would say is that I think initial models of this, I assumed a constant expected loss ratio because that means that, you know, 11 parameters rather than 20. And so I thought, no, we can actually handle 20. Okay, and allow for those things to change. And again, right there, there needs to be arguments or observations that we can do to detect these changes.
I mean, I'd say I'd agree with you. I'd say you're absolutely right. However, I would say that what you often hear is, this is what's happening. We want a model that does this. So, in other words, the cry is for the final answer that provides the answers to everything that you can't do in practice, or that, you know, you have all these problems. I see it in a slightly different way. I think that stochastic models are very important, and you need to take a number of steps along the way. The first thing is to say, right, let's get these stochastic models incorporated, understood, and accepted. And how are you going to do that? You start with the most basic, simple things, such as chain ladder. You get that understood, you get people, we've come a long way, people now understand the difference between a standard error and a prediction error. They understand what a predictive distribution is, they understand the importance of the assumptions that you make in it. Once you've done that, then you can start thinking in a slightly different way. I think chain ladder is rubbish. I've said it, I've stood up at Gyro when I was quite young, and I said, you know, in 5 years' time, no one's going to be using chain ladder. I'm not stupid enough to say that now, but I hope that as time goes by, chain ladder becomes less used, because you need to understand what's going on in your data. You need to understand the processes. The problem with that is that then the models become less easy to understand, and you need to invest a lot more time. Than we've had some very, you know, good papers here that I've heard about, some very interesting and complicated models which try to model the underlying processes in a lot more detail and to think about those. I hope that's where we're moving to, and I hope that we're moving away from the stage where everybody says, well, chain ladder is what you have to use because everybody else uses it. And I hope that you get to the point where you can think about things in a much more clever way. Think about the underlying processes, what's driving the data, what's changed, how you can get through those, and then how you can estimate that from the data. I still don't like that way of doing it, of looking at development factors and selecting them. I think you need to think more about what's going on. What are the drivers? Where are the inflation drivers? Where are the calendar year effects? What's going on with those? And all those types of things for individual claims. Maybe you can't look at individual claims because you haven't got them, but you can think about what's going on and derive a model that you can estimate from the data that you've got, and not just sort of say, well, okay, I'm going to look at individual development factors, cross out those ones, I don't like those. You know, they're too big, that's never going to happen again. Well, how do you know it's never going to happen again? You know, I just don't like that way of doing it, personally. Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a second issue there, which is how do we get things known? Because I think there is a general problem that people in the US don't read journals that are printed in the Europe, and people in Europe perhaps don't read US journals. And then there are statistical journals where things get published. So, for example, there's work done on claims inflation and calendar year effects, which are published in Biometrica. And I'm absolutely certain that no actuaries read Biometrica at all, but it's quite important work. There are things published in the Aston Bulletin. What percentage of US actuaries read the Aston Bulletin? What percentage of UK actuaries read the Aston Bulletin? I bet it's less than 1%. You know, so I think the importance of this type of thing and of journals that try to address practical issues such as variance, which is trying to tread that fine line between scientific papers and real practical issues, I think they're so important. And it's very difficult to get it across and get it out there. But, you know, there are things going on and there are interesting papers being written if you have time to read them all and sort out which ones are the interesting ones.
Yeah. I think I'd second that. There's actually, in the latest couple of Aston bulletins, you know, we're starting to see stuff with the Tweedy and, you know, I think Worthrich and company are coming up with some very interesting papers that I'm starting to follow very closely as well.
Mm.
Any other questions? Well, if you could join me in congratulating our authors. Thank you for attending.
Do you agree? I mean, one of